What Witch, This, That, or the Other? From Bonnaroo to Coachella, traversing the music festival landscape can be tricky. That's where we come in with high fives for everyone. The What Podcast with Brad Barry, Lord Taco, dedicated to exploring the entire festival scene.
Brad has worked in the radio industry for more than 20 years and currently lives in Brooklyn, where he is program director for three stations, including one in New York, one in Detroit, and one in Miami.
Barry's been a reporter for the Chattanooga Times Free Press, covering all aspects of the entertainment industry since 1987. That's before you were born.
Lord Taco, the smart guy who makes these podcasts on our website at thewhatpodcast.com work, also really good at identifying babies, loves blue-haired moms, PBR, and his beautiful Volkswagen bus.
We all fell in love with the Bonnaroo Festival years ago, not only because of the amazing bands that play there every year, but also because of the incredible community spirit that has developed around it. Radiate positivity.
And we really like talking about the inside baseball stuff when it comes to putting on a huge music festival. So join us.
You can hear the What Podcast on the Consequence Podcast Network or anywhere you find your favorite podcasts.
Hey pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
I'm Carrie Corrigan, and this is The Opus, an exploration of legendary records and their ongoing legacy. In our latest season, I'm joined by Lizzie Hale, Warren Zanes, Daphne A. Brooks, and many more to revisit Jeff Buckley's Grace. We discuss Buckley's femininity in an era of hyper-masculine alt-rock, how the record's mythology was shaped by his tragic death, and the delicate work of keeping his legacy alive. Find us at Consequence of Sound or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Consequence Podcast Network.
To all of you beautiful pod people out there, I'm your host, Leor Phillips, and this is another edition of This Must Be The Gig. It's your little backstage pass to the world of live music. Each and every single week, I bring you a fascinating conversation from the beating heart of the live music and performance scene. And what that means is really chatting to musicians about what makes them tick on tour, festival founders about why they curate certain lineups they curate, choreographers, comedians about their favorite concerts and performances, and actors. Really anyone obsessed with performance in the way that we are over here. But before we get into this week's episode, let's check in with our constant companion here at TMBTG Studios, Engineer Adam. I'm talking very fast.
Yeah, I love how...
I had a lot of coffee.
I love that intro every single time, I gotta say.
Why?
I feel my heart flutter, my head lift. I'm just like, oh, that's right. I am this constant companion.
Well, I also have to always introduce the show just in case we have new listeners.
Absolutely.
It's boring for the people that continue to listen, but
it's
thank you.
It's music to my ears every time, so I can't say it's boring.
What's happening with you? What's going on?
I've been doing some hardcore binging
of
sci-fi and fantasy TV shows from my past. Yeah. It's just what I've been up to.
What have you been watching?
Started to rewatch Buffy from the beginning.
We are watching that together.
That's true. Everyone out there, we're sharing that rewatch. Also, The X-Files.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to say, I was inspired by this week's episode, hint, hint again, to watch Fringe as well. Which I know is
you
one of your time.
You sounded like a a game show host.
I'm watching Fringe.
And that's like the last... sorry. That is one of my all-time favorite shows.
I know. I was inspired.
It was around the same time as Dollhouse and... What else was around that time?
Was Millennium about then too? Or is that a little earlier?
I don't know.
Your voice.
just resonant, baby. That's all it is. But that's enough TV chat for one intro, I believe.
That's not enough.
No?
But anyway, I think that we just need to get to the episode.
Yes. Let's get to the interview this week. We also wanted to let you know, as always, it's very important. It has to be done. Give us 5 stars wherever you listen to your podcast.
Parentheses, if you like us, give us 5 stars and review us and subscribe. It is all one clicky away from your dreams.
Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you're listening, it has an option to go rate us, review, and subscribe. It is a big deal. Go get it done. It's important.
It's a dream within a dream.
Reach out on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, what have you, at TMBTGpod, at Lior Phillips. Let us know what you're thinking, what you'd like to see in the future from the show. We love chatting with you.
And in your review, what you could do instead of leaving something boring and utterly dry and sobering, why don't you just leave us a little concert experience of yours?
Yeah, tell us about your favorite concert.
Mm-hmm. And or any other episodes that you loved, or suggest maybe guests that you want to see on the show.
Ooh,
We are now on episode 64.
Holy moly, Nintendo 64 episode.
Yes, fast and reliable. And also 64 squares on a chessboard.
And I believe it's the code for New Zealand internationally.
This is great. This is all impromptu, improv.
Oh, yeah.
By the
Off
way,
the
that's
top
what
of the
we
head.
Do. So we do over
we
here.
We know things.
But one thing we do know is that this guest is one that we are unbelievably inspired by and someone that I've been wanting to chat to ever since I was in the live audience of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me live in Chicago at the Chase Bank Theater. Do I sound like him?
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a fantastic show. Lance Reddick was the guest. And immediately when he's beautifully mellow and
mellifluous.
His voice is just so soothing.
Absolutely.
And I loved how charming and energetic he was. The audience loved him. They were making visual hand signals like thumbs and clapping and facial expressions of smiling, and there was teeth
joy
involved.
Joy and beauty.
It was great. I really enjoyed that. So I tracked him down. And I have the one and only Lance Reddick for everybody. He is the star of so many shows.
Oh, yeah.
Star of The Wire, Fringe, The New Bosch, John
Lost.
Wick.
Lost.
Lost. So much. We also explore what it takes for an artist like him to focus and perform in the middle of dozens of cast and crew members. We chat about a really challenging experience that he had and also how he overcame it and how he started in the acting world and what really brought him. We kind of go through the entire trajectory of his career.
When they're making the Lance Reddick biopic in
they can
like
listen back
20
to this.
Years, they could just listen to this episode and it's got everything.
He's been able to really go above and beyond in all of his roles. We talk about American Horror Story, how he studies for accents.
Amazing.
That we haven't
yeah.
been able to do before. Just a really beautiful open chat about performance, which is exactly what we do here.
Absolutely.
And I felt blessed and completely in wonder and awe. And we also chat about his initial dream of becoming a musician with his, we chat about his album.
Contemplations and Remembrances, which is fantastic. He lived that dream. It's incredible.
Yeah. And we also just discover some of his earliest experiences as a performer and so much more. So let us not be delayed. This is me and Lance Reddick. Enjoy! I think the best place to start is where does your story start? What did you always want to be in the arts when you were younger?
Yes. I mean, I started acting is something that developed much later in my life, but music. My mother was an instrumental music teacher in the city schools in Baltimore. So that was kind of my first introduction to music because she had it in the house all the time. And my we had a piano in the house, excuse me, that my mother would use to prepare things for her students.
Mm-hmm.
And so I used to sit at the piano pretending that I was playing. and I would just bang on the piano.
Oh my God.
My mother's, yeah, my mother very quickly said, "You can't do that. If you want to, play the piano, you have to take lessons."
Yes.
And being a little kid, I just thought, "Well, okay, I don't know what that is, but that sounds fun." So I said, "Yeah." So I started taking lessons when I was 6 years old.
Wow! And did you love it, or did you just want to be able to be part of something musical? Did you particularly like that instrument?
What's interesting? Well, I did. I love the piano.
Mm.
I did take to music right away. What was always touch and go was that I loved to play, but I hated to practice.
Mm.
And I was from a very early age, I was drawn to pop music, but my studies were in classical music. And so even though I developed a love for classical music, my first love was always kind of popular music. I progressed from studying privately with a local teacher to studying. By the time I was in junior high school, I started studying piano at the Peabody, at the prep department of the Peabody Conservatory.
Oh, right. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And then my in eighth grade, I started studying music theory. My music on Saturday after, and I don't even know why, the music theory teacher said, "You know what? There's this summer camp that I teach at that I think you might be great for." And it's a place called the Walden School, which to this day, I donate to them every year because it was an experience that changed my life. And so all through high school, every summer we would board a bus in Baltimore and drive up to, at first it was Vermont. And then later we moved to another location, school in New Hampshire. And for 5 weeks we would study composition and music theory.
So how then did you go from that? Because obviously, I think we all share the same thing. If anybody wants to do something versus actually going through the motion of having to practice it, it gets so frustrating after a while because there's so many rules and there's so many things, especially when with regard to classical music. But then how did you transition into the career that you have today? Or do you have both? Because I don't know how prominent music is still in your life.
It's interesting. I professionally, I don't think I've ever worked as a musician. I recorded one CD about a little over 10 years ago. It's called Contemplations and Remembrances.
Ooh.
And it was, it's actually a CD of predominantly jazz songs. There's one pop rock tune on there that I wrote when I was 25 years old. But it's most of the music is music that I started writing in my 30s, well after I was well after I'd left drama school and I was working professionally as an actor. So let me backtrack a little bit.
Yes.
I went to the University of Rochester for college, and the main reason I applied to the University of Rochester was because the Eastman School of Music is part of the university. So even though I didn't apply to Eastman, for some reason, I just wanted to be around that. Believe it or not, I was actually a physics major. My first semester at the U of R, I went to a concert at Eastman, and I walked out of there thinking, this is where I belong. So I applied as a transfer student in composition.
Mm-hmm.
I got in, and then the next year I was a composition major at Eastman.
Ah.
And I was there for the next, well, I was going to say 4 years, the next 5 years. There was 1 year that I stayed in Rochester, but I took a year off.
Okay.
And I had an affinity for math, and I always loved music theory, but it was like pulling teeth to get me. I frustrated the heck out of my teachers, my piano and my composition teachers, because it was just, I had so many other interests. The truth was, I just didn't really want to be a classical composer. I really wanted to be a rock star.
Yeah.
One of my best friends at Eastman was obsessed with Sting and Sondheim.
Okay.
And he bugged the heck out of me to listen to Sting's first solo album, Dreams of the Blue Turtles.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wouldn't listen to it. One day I was in his room hanging out and he says, "We're going to listen to this right now." I'm like, "Oh, geez, no, really?" And he made me sit and listen to the album. And I was like, "It's okay."
Mm.
And he did the same thing with Sweeney Todd. One summer, I went to visit him at his. I spent a weekend with him. Stayed at his folks' house in New Jersey. He was from New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
His name's David Wallenberger, and he forced me to sit down and put headphones on me, and we listened to the entire Sweeney Todd, the entire musical.
By force.
Well, kind of. But, you know, by the time it was over, I was like, I've never heard anything like this.
Yes, of course.
This is genius.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I left music school. I dropped out of music school without graduating. I got married straight out of school. And with this dream of kind of being this rock star, but with no plan.
Mm.
And one day I was driving and I hear Free Free Set Them Free, mm-hmm, on the radio. And I was like, even though 3 or 4 years earlier, David had kind of forced me to listen to the album, I didn't really get it. And I listened to it and I was thinking, wow, what's that? Like, I don't know. Like, I haven't heard music like that before, pop music like that before.
Mm.
So I went out and I bought the album. And I started listening to it over and over again. And slowly but surely, like song after song, I'd be like, I'm not sure what he's doing here. What, you know?
Yeah.
And then I'd listen to it and then slowly be like, oh, that's what he's doing. And that's, you know what I mean? Because Sting was, you know, he was really kind of breaking open the boundaries, you know, as far as I was concerned, I'm trying to think of the right way to say this.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to make it sound like, I don't think that pop music is real art, but
right.
I felt that there was a sophistication that he was able to successfully bring, not just to his songwriting, not just compositionally, which was incredibly sophisticated, but poetically.
Right.
You know, and that was one of the other things that I got out of Stephen Sondheim, just how he wrote words.
Mm.
And so when I write songs, I'd say the people that influenced me the most, just in terms of how I approach writing lyrics, are Sting and Stephen Sondheim.
So when you heard that, and you had obviously you'd left the school for music, what in terms of trying to pursue, you know, that life as a rock star, how did you land up then with acting? What was the trajectory? Because obviously dreams of being a rock star, that never really dies, and you can essentially be a rock star, you know, as your characters in different roles. You can have that bravado and that presence, and it's still performing. So how did you get into that?
Well, what's interesting about the acting is that the first experience I ever had acting was an assignment that I had in English class when I was 15 years old.
Wow.
So we were reading Macbeth, and I never ended up reading the play, but we were told to prepare a monologue, and I was already, it's funny, I was a big Star Trek fan, and I had read somewhere that William Shatner was a Shakespearean actor.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, one day, completely independent of this assignment, I had opened up one of my father's old college books of Shakespeare plays, anthologies, and I opened it to Brutus's famous speech, Romans, Countrymen, and Lovers, that he gives when he's trying to calm the crowd down after they found out that they've murdered Caesar.
Yes.
And I tried to imagine how would William Shatner do it.
I love that he was your, because obviously, you know, if you are a fan of that franchise, you get so into it, you know, and you want to study every single thing. But I don't think that's a bad starting point, because that is the theatrics and the drama behind that kind of acting. And to be honest, his delivery, people, you know, say it's comical, but it's fantastic that he commits to things, you know.
Well, the interesting thing about Shatner is if you watch the show, he started that kind of melodramatic, almost falling into particular patterns of rhythm and tune,
right?
That have become what people parody.
Mm.
He started falling into in the second season, but the first season he did really beautiful naturalistic work. that was really very cinematic.
So you had already had a little taste of it. So what was your, because obviously the fixation with music comes from many different areas. The fixation with acting, with arts, comes from so many different angles. But then what?
Well, I grew up addicted to television.
Yeah.
I grew up addicted to television.
So did we all. Yeah.
But the thing about it is I never considered being an actor, never growing up.
Wow.
But it was when I something about having to prepare this monologue, because I did the "If it were done, when tis if it were done, when tis done" speech, the famous monologue that Macbeth has when he's trying to kind of convince himself to murder the king,
mm-hmm.
And preparing that because I hated doing homework as much as I hated practicing, but for some reason I just became obsessed with preparing the speech. And so when we got up to do the monologues and I stood up, it was like something magic happened. And I was doing something that nobody else was doing. I wasn't just saying a line, I was being the character. And then I thought, well, that was a cool experience. And then I kind of put it away.
Mm.
That was my sophomore year. Then my senior year, I auditioned for a play at school. For one of the leads, I didn't get it, and I ended up being cast as the dealer. It was the musical Fiorello, so I had three lines. And then when I got to college, for some reason, I just thought, you know what? I want to act. I want to I could be good at this.
Mm.
So that was my extracurricular thing. That was my thing that I did just for fun.
Mm.
So at least once a year, I would do a play. When I transferred to Eastman, I'd go over to the university and I'd find time to do a play every year. it was the only thing in my life I ever did just for fun. So fast forward, after I've dropped out of college, I get married a little over a year and a half after I got married, I found out that my wife was pregnant.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Yeah, and you know, I'm working in a jewelry and lap and jewelry and crystal store doing lap gear work in the back room, you know, learning to and listening to Sting all day long.
Maybe that's why she got pregnant so quickly, you know, Sting's the man.
Well, maybe, but anyway, I found myself within a year after my daughter was born, working three jobs, 7 days a week.
Mm.
And I had when I first moved, because I was living in Boston at the time, I moved to Boston from Rochester, New York, which is where Eastman is.
Mm.
And so I hooked up with a recording studio in Boston that I'd done a demo tape that kind of butchered my songs. they really kind of taken the edge off them. To try to make him quote unquote more commercial. And I had a back injury about a year after my daughter was born that laid me up for about a month.
Oh no.
And it was rough. Because I wasn't making much money as it was. But it was a situation where I realized that one of the things I had to come to terms with was the fact that the recording studio was just taking me for a ride and they were never going to get me a record deal.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing was,
and
the other thing was that I had to come up with some other approach to how I was living my life or I was going to be doing this for the rest of my life.
Right.
And I had no idea what possessed me, but I thought, well, you know I can sing, I know I can act.
Mm.
So let me try that. So I just started going on local musical theater auditions. And after two of those, I realized I have a nice voice, but I'm really a songwriter who sings, but these people are singers.
Mm.
And so then I just started going on straight theater auditions, non-equity theater auditions in Boston. And I started just very quickly getting cast and doing theater. About 6 to 12 months into it, I started taking an on-camera course at this casting director. I don't know if they're still around, called Collins Pickman. Patty Collins was my teacher, and she really liked me, so she started bringing me in for on-camera stuff. And then on a lark, and this, it's its own story. I don't know if we have time for it, but
We've got time.
one of the things I did that allowed me to go on auditions and to have rehearsals and plays was because Boston has so many schools and so many art schools. I started working as an artist model because it was very easy to have flexible hours, and it was, you know, if something came up, you could just get a list of other models and call somebody to come take over, you know, and come sub for you.
Mm.
So there was an artist named Lou Gepetti, who I was working at a school in Boston called the Museum School, and he taught there. And I was very popular with one of his drawing classes. I modeled off his drawing classes, and so he requested to paint me privately. So I started modeling for him privately, and I would just sit in his chair in these green khaki pants and this old football jersey that I had from high school.
Yeah.
And he would paint me, and we would just talk for 3 hours at a time. And and he'd have the radio on, and we'd talk about anything from movies to music to politics. Mm. And one day he asked me about training. And being the naive, arrogant guy that I was, I said, well, you don't need to train to be an actor. You just learn as you go.
Oh,
even though I was finding out that the bigger the roles were, the less consistent my work was, unless I had a really good director, and if the writing was bad, I was completely lost.
Right, right.
So, but in that conversation, I said to him, "Well, the only place I even consider, you know, I wanted to go. I said I want to go to New York. I just want to go to New York, and I want to study at the Actors Studio because that's all I knew, you know." And then I said this really kind of bizarre thing. I said, the only other place I'd even consider applying is Yale. And I couldn't get into Yale anyway because I never finished my bachelor's degree. And the only reason I said that was because I knew Meryl Streep went to Yale. I didn't know anything else about the Yale Drama School except that Meryl Streep went there.
Mm.
I was literally talking out of my ass, just making conversation. And he says to me, well, you know, you might want to consider applying because I have my master's in painting from Yale. And I don't. And I don't have a bachelor's degree because I went to a diploma school.
Mm. Wow.
So I left that, and I don't know what, but something about that conversation, I just couldn't stop thinking about it. So I called up information. I got the number of the drama school, and I called them, and I asked them what the deal was if you didn't have a bachelor's degree.
Mm.
And they said that you could apply to the drama school as a certificate student. It's exactly the same program. And you could, if you got in, you could just go through as a certificate student. And if you ever got your bachelor's degree, all you needed to do was to send the drama school proof of your bachelor's degree, and they'll give you your master's.
Oh wow!
So
okay.
I was like, okay. So I applied. Yeah, I applied. I got the application. I saw that I think it was like $50. Like, damn, yeah, $50. Wow.
Yeah.
And then I needed two recommendations. I got one recommendation from the artistic director at a place called the Wheelock Family Theater, which was attached to Wheelock College in Boston. And she gave me, and I'd done a couple plays there. She gave me a very lukewarm recommendation.
Oh.
And then I had another recommendation that was stellar. And I don't know why, but something possessed me to look through the application again. And even though it's the same, it doesn't make any sense, but because it's the same program, I had to do exactly the same coursework as everybody else. But as a certificate student, number one, they didn't need your grades.
Okay.
And you only needed one recommendation.
Oh, wow.
So I threw out the bad one.
You're a clever man. Yeah.
And I sent it in, and then you had to prepare two contrasting monologues for your audition. And one of them had to be in verse. And being a guy who didn't like to study, from high school, I didn't remember what verse was. So I was asking one of my acting buddies, what's verse? And he said, well, something Shakespeare or Greek. And I said, so anything Shakespeare? He said, no. So he broke down iambic pentameter for me.
Mm.
And so, and interestingly enough, I had just done, for the theater that where I'd gotten the really great recommendation, I had kind of done a benefit performance. It was like an evening of Shakespeare, and I had done a scene from Othello with a friend of mine.
Oh wow!
And the guy who was directing our scene had handed me these VHS cassette tapes of John Barton there was a show in the UK in the 80s called Playing Shakespeare, where John Barton and the RSC would do scene study. So I there was all these tapes of like Patrick Stewart and Judi Dench and Ian McKellen, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
From the 80s, you know, doing scene study with John Barton.
Wow.
So I actually took a scene from the beginning of The Merchant of Venice that I watched Ian McKellen doing with someone else. And I took a piece of dialogue and I formed it into a monologue.
Mm. Wow. I mean, that is a fantastic teacher to, you know, even if it is through a VHS or a tape or, you know, what have you.
Yeah.
What an incredible teacher to, and he was young then as well. When was that? That was in the 90s. And that tape was what?
This
from
was
the
in 1991.
80s? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. This was 91 that I did this.
Yes.
Because that's when I applied. Oh no, I'm wrong. It was 1990 because my first year was 91.
Okay.
So, yeah, So I applied, and then I got in.
Wow. And that felt, I mean, you obviously took the necessary steps to get in, you know, to enroll into the course, but it definitely took a lot of perseverance just internally, I can imagine, and emotionally switching gears, going for a specific career, you know, because when you're younger and you think you have all these plans and these dreams and these ideas, but when you actually get into practice it, it's such a different experience. So then what did that teach you then about yourself, you know, going into a different career, being so new to it? What did that teach you?
Well, it's interesting. It taught me a few different things. First of all, that sometimes the notions that you have about what you want out of your life don't necessarily have to do with where you're, I don't want to say destiny lies because that's too hairy fairy. But
that's loud.
But what's interesting is that music is my first love, but acting is what I was born to do.
Absolutely.
Because acting is the only thing that I ever did just for fun. I mean, until I started pursuing it, you know what I mean? And the other thing is that coming to it later in life, the disadvantage that I had was that I came to it without any training, and the advantage that I had was that I came to it without any training.
Right. So you weren't jaded.
Without any formal acting training and that I was older, because what that did was I was able to bring a certain weight and life experience to my work that even when I was at Yale, other than my classmates didn't have. And the other thing is because I struggled so hard, being broke and trying, like there was at one point at which we couldn't pay our rent anymore, and another family took us in. So we were living with another family from the time that my daughter was about a year old until she was for a year. We lived with them until we got back on our feet.
So it was high stakes when I got to Yale,
I just worked harder than anybody else.
Right. Which makes it, of course, so much more fulfilling and rewarding to go into something as opposed to having a privilege and or some sort of training that you feel you are then. Because training often leads to connections, right? When you're working with a teacher who's like, oh, I see a talent, and then they put you in touch with an agent. And sometimes it happens like that for many people. But 95% of the rest of the of the population have to work and grind through it for that big break.
Well, in terms of connections, just the way that Yale is set up, because at the time, kind of the top drama schools in the country were Yale, Juilliard, and NYU.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is, there's something called the league. They call them the league scenes. I don't know why they call the league scenes, but they're basically audition scenes for the industry that are set up by the schools.
Okay.
And Yale and Juilliard and NYU used to do them all together, and then Juilliard started doing their own thing. And so when I got out of drama school, we did ours with NYU. So, and we did ours in New York. Now Yale actually does them in New York, and they do them in Los Angeles. So we had audition scene. We basically had to come up with two contrasting audition scenes. We had to find partners within our class. And I did one dramatic scene, which actually my partner ended up writing for us. And the other scene was a comic scene that I did with Paul Giamatti.
Oh,
which is great.
I love Paul.
Yeah, Paul was, Paul was in my class. Yeah.
What a fantastic, that is a character. What a fantastic, he's an artist, I think. You can't even call him an actor.
Oh,
he's
he was fantastic. The smartest, most talented person in the class, hands down. Like, if I was the hardest worker and the most tenaciously analytical, Paul was just the smartest and most talented. So it was just one of those things where he was a star from the first day of class. And he was just practicing being a star for 3 years. Which I'm not saying he didn't grow and he didn't learn,
yes,
but it was like,
but he
there
had
was
it
Paul
from
and
the
there
start.
Was everybody else. Yeah.
But that's
whereas
humbling.
I was the guy that kept getting better and kept getting better and kept getting,
yes,
better and kept getting better because I just worked so freaking hard.
So
I was so ruthlessly honest with myself.
Right. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
But and that's also quite humbling, right? To know it's high stakes. So much is riding on your involvement and the amount of effort that you're putting into it. But also that you can put, it's all a competition, right? So you're going to naturally put yourself up against everybody around you. But you also have to grow. So it's a very, very interesting balance that you have to try and tackle.
Well, it's interesting. Because for me, I feel that a lot of people, I feel like I have a tricky personality because I'm not very competitive,
okay,
but I'm very ambitious. But
yeah.
I'm very ambitious.
Yes, I relate to that. Yes.
So the thing that I had to, and once again, being older helped me. The thing that I realized very quickly on was that competing with everybody else wasn't going to work. I had to set a goal. So and the goal that I set was I want to be the best transformational character actor in the world. That's what I want to do. And so I said, well, so in order to gain, the other thing I understood about goals is that in order to achieve something, you have to be able to quantify it. So even if it's arbitrary, you have to make up some kind, you know what I mean? So I looked at the people who I thought were the best at that. And it was Meryl Streep and Daniel Day-Lewis and his prime, John Voight, and Kathy Bates, and to a certain extent, Dustin Hoffman. And I would go on, when I was in drama school, I would pick actors and I would go on binges and I would just go through their work.
Yeah.
And
that can teach you a lot as well. It can teach you not only looking at your peers around you,
yeah,
but also looking at the greats and being inspired. So it can also teach you a lot about your approach. It's like taking, as you said, quantifying. It's taking all this information and then picking the right path that suits your personality, suits your goals. It's like a maths equation. No wonder you were so interested in in theory and how things, join together. I think that's an interesting connection.
Oh, I think that helped me being so analytical. Because always had an affinity for math.
Mm.
So I think that helped too. But so anyway, so my thing was, whenever I would get caught up in how I'm doing compared to everybody else, or how, because everybody wanted to be a star. The thing that I saw people fall into consistently was everybody wanted to be the star at the school, and they wanted to be a star in each production. My thing was, I'm not saying I didn't want that, but what was more important to me was what am I going to learn today that's going to make me better tomorrow? And what did I learn less yesterday that I can practice today that's going to make me better?
Mm.
So I feel like I learned as much from my mistakes as I learned from my, people would screw up and they'd shut down. And my attitude was I'd screw up and then I'd say, okay, how do I use this to, what can I learn to make myself better in the next one?
But that's an unbelievable attitude, especially considering somebody who is up against, you're up against so much pressure, not only financially, but also just to prove something to yourself. Because often when you aren't competitive and very ambitious, your toughest critic is
the internal loud character that comes that from your own ego. And so I can only imagine how tough that was for you to navigate, and how I think that's such a great way to approach something new. You know, instead of stumbling and cracking, I call it like robot mode, you know, when you just shut down, you took it and ran with it. I think that's incredibly inspiring. I haven't really discussed this much with a lot of people, but I think that that's an amazing thing to acknowledge.
But I mean, if I'd gone when I was 21, that wouldn't have been the case.
Right.
But going at 29, because the other thing is, I was one of the oldest people, not only one of the oldest people in my class, but one of the oldest people in the school my first year. I mean, I was 29 years old my first year.
I know you say that old, and it's like, that's so young. But obviously people start when they're 17.
Yeah, I mean, the youngest person in my class was 21. And, you know, people go to Juilliard, you know, out of high school. So
yeah.
I don't know much about that program, but to me that's weird. Where some people come from college, and you do the Juilliard drama school as graduate school, but some people come straight out of high school. So you got 18-year-olds with 25, 26-year-olds in the same starting class.
But that puts you at a different level, of course, because when you're preparing for a role, you have so many more years and references and experiences of your own, which I think is something that you said earlier, which I found really interesting, is how much of your personal life you use towards your role, because every actor is different, every performer is different. And how much, because you are known for these iconic characters, you know, from playing Cedric Daniels in The Wire to Philip Broyles in Fringe, and your characters are so memorable. So how much of you is in that, or at least in the preparation part of acting?
That's a tricky question to answer. Here's why.
Okay.
And I feel like it wouldn't be so tricky if I were in England.
Okay.
But the thing that I've noticed fairly consistently about American actors, particularly film attachment, theater much less so, the tendency is to basically play themselves all the time.
Yeah.
And you know, I my whole thing was learning how to transform into other characters. I mean, one of the things that drew me to acting, even for fun in college, was the fact that I could get out of myself.
Right,
I could
you can
kind
escape.
Of be and express all the things that I didn't feel comfortable being and expressing in my life. So on the one hand, and also with my career, it's tricky because after The Wire, I got typecast a little bit.
Yeah, you were always kind of like these intimidating authority figures, you know, had these long monologues.
You see The Wire, and you see Fringe, and you see
Lost.
Irving in Bosch, and you think, well, he's kind of playing the same guy. I mean, to me, I'm not. They're all different, but by the same token, they're such similar types that. You think people who don't know my work think that's me.
That's who
I mean,
you
and people are shocked when they meet me, and then they think that I see that I'm nothing like this guy.
You're not gonna.
Yeah, I mean,
you're not gonna be arresting me or telling me my rights or.
or even that kind of alpha dominant personality. I mean, that's not me.
No,
I don't even talk like those guys.
No,
but by
you
the same
don't.
Token, there's a weight. Like I think it's very difficult to play how you are in a relationship in a marriage if you've never been married.
Of course.
You know, I'll never forget that there was a scene in Fringe, and I'm angry that I didn't fight the director about it, where it's the alternate universe, and I've basically betrayed my world for this drug to help save my son because he's got this terminal disease. Jared Harris's character plays like the evil scientist.
Yes.
And so I'm working undercover for him, you know, as Broyles in the alternate universe. And so there's a scene where I've just come from a funeral, and of one of my people, that was caused by my actions.
Mm.
And I'm devastated
about it. I remember that. Mm.
And I come in the door and my wife asks me how I am. And my initial choice was, I mean, to say, well, first of all, the line was, I'm fine. But my initial choice was to go through the mail.
Right.
And the director was like, no, it's not about the mail. You want to leave me in your eyes. And the thing he didn't understand was that I'm not playing the mail. I'm playing avoiding her eyes.
Mm, exactly. Because, trying to get away from
one of the,
her.
You know, one, yeah. Yeah, because one of the things we've established that was different in the alternate universe was from the primary universe. Is in the primary universe, my marriage would fall apart because work was always first
mm-hmm.
and family was second. Whereas in the alternate universe, the difference was that family was first, and so, which is why I was still married. So anybody who's been in a relationship where it's so intimate that you know that if you're trying to hide something or lie,
yeah.
your partner, they look in your eyes and they know something's off immediately.
Well, you don't even have to say anything. As you said, you literally going through the mail can be that marker of you are distant. Something's disconnected. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, things that you become known for, you know, also a successful franchise like John Wick, all these things that can become like this gilded cage that you can't get out of, which there are worse things in life, of course, than being, you know, put into these character roles and being known for that.
Well,
you know?
Except for the thing with John Wick, though, is that it's so different from, I mean, it's interesting.
It's so different, yes.
The fall that I fought, that I shot the pilot for Bosch
mm-hmm.
is also that same fall I shot John Wick and I shot my season of American Horror Story.
Oh, wow.
Three completely, completely different characters. There's some people to this day who don't realize that American Horror Story was me.
That American Horror Story role was obviously such a huge departure from what you've normally done. And I'm not talking just aesthetically, but also your performative style. So how did you prepare for something like that, knowing that you have this perception amongst your fans who love you? You know, you have such a loyal, there's people that love you a lot. So how did you make sure that you prepared for something that might change their, you know, perception of you?
Oh, I didn't even think about that. I didn't think about, oh, how's the fans going to see me differently?
Right.
I just thought, how do I prepare for this role? Because I've never wanted to be thought of as a particular role as a particular type. So for me, it was like, this is what I got into acting for. So the hardest, believe it or not, the hardest thing for me was how often scripts changed and how, because of how secretive they were,
yeah.
they didn't email scripts
oh.
or signs. So, you know, so the first hardest thing for me was learning the Haitian accent.
How are you with accents? Because I know that you obviously do a Kenyan accent in John Wick, but then how are you with accents?
I mean, I have an ear for accents, but I mean, I was scrambling along trying to find, you know what I mean? Find accents, yeah. Find that accent.
Mm.
The main source actually ended up being a documentary about Haiti.
Okay.
I just had to watch it over and over and over and over again and listen to people and start writing down kind of how different vowels, and you know what I mean, and also kind of get a general sense of what it was, because the thing I started realizing is it's almost an African accent with a French, it's a mixture of an African and a French accent.
Well, yeah, if you look at the history, I mean, talk about your analytical brain. If you study the history of people from Haiti and who visited
yeah.
and who took over, it's all a mishmash, you know. I mean, like, I'm South African, as you can hear. And for me,
yes.
it's, you know, there's Dutch and German and, you know, whoever colonized South Africa, the Brits. So I sound like half Australian, half British, half Dutch, you know, because obviously Afrikaans. So there's so many beautiful background things that could inform your, you know, your accent. But Haitian is very difficult. I have to say that out of a lot of them, you know, it's hard for even just the listener to pinpoint it, because it is known, but not spoken widely on, you know, commercial US shows.
Yeah.
So that's a tricky, that must've been quite a challenge.
I mean, obviously, I had to do some research around the lore, the what kind of character it was, in terms of who Papa Legba is in mythology. But ultimately, you know, I had to get into the psychology of the character. And the thing that I started realizing as I started preparing for him is that he loves, I mean, he just gets so much joy out of his work. He loves taking souls.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like,
my hair stuck up at the back of my neck.
The thing that comes to my mind is kind of, it's Fagin and Oliver Twist and just kind of rubbing their hands together and you know what I mean? So that's how I got into character. Yeah.
And talking about that, what kind of atmosphere do you want to feel on set? Because I think that preparing for a role, and obviously what we talk about on the show constantly is, you know, performance and the way that people tackle that. But I also think that the atmosphere that you want around you is so important, or at least something that you need to be inspired. You have to cultivate a really positive feeling. So what is your ultimate idea, I suppose, of the perfect atmosphere for you to thrive on set?
Everybody's there to do the work, and everybody's there to have a good time. Nothing is more, for me, nothing is more destructive than an actor or a director. And I've had this experience mostly with actors, although I had it with one director, and it was a television director. Someone who recurred on Fringe, and it was a nightmare every time I had to work with a guy. But there's nothing more destructive than an actor whose main focus is being the center of attention all the time and not the work. You know, it's interesting. I was talking to Michael Seitzman about this. I recurred for a very short time, and it was in the same period of time, on a show called Intelligence, that Josh Holloway starred on. That was a great set. But I was talking, when I was meeting with Michael about the character, he said it really perfectly. He said, it only takes one asshole.
What, to ruin the day? Just one asshole?
To ruin the atmosphere, yeah.
God, I can imagine. Yeah. But how do you then deal with that? Because, you know, a lot of actors that I've spoken to, or performers, Broadway stars, I've spoken to them a little bit about, you know, following some sort of mental or physical health regime so that they can, you know, feel good leading up to and during performance. But how do you then deal with something when you are set to shoot in, you know, 15 minutes and you've got this absolute asshole around you, sucking up all the life on set? How do you get into the zone?
It's tough because I've run into it twice. Once was, well, actually three times. One was... two of them were on a series. So the people that I had to work with for years. The first one, it was hit or miss depending on the day. And he was really only awful when we were in a group because it was a class clown thing. And he was kind of bored and he didn't want to be there.
And
the other person it took me a while to realize it, partly because first season he and I didn't have any problems. And in second season we had more and more stuff to do together. And, he was intimidated by me. So what he would do was he would do all kinds of subtle little stuff to try to throw me off.
Right.
So that, you know, do you know what I mean? So that I wouldn't outshine him, which is the, you know, because it's interesting. You know, I was listening. I just finished listening to the Walter Isaacson biography of Steve Jobs. And Steve Jobs said a really great thing. He said, A-list people want to work with other A-list people. So, I mean, invariably not always true, because one person who's actually a nightmare and who did things to try to mess up my performance is actually, I think she's very talented, but she's also she became a star very young, and this was in a film, and she grew up with both her parents are in the industry, so the nepotism, so there's a sense of entitlement.
Absolutely, imagine.
So the brat, I got to be the star and I got to be center of attention. If anybody. I relate to everybody according to my perception of their status or my perception of how other people are going to, how the group is going to see me.
Right. Well, also because you know who you are. So there's that firm grounding in who you are. And it could, honestly, just coming from just, I'm in the music industry, you can imagine the ego. And sometimes it's sometimes not even directed at you, but because most of us, especially women in, you know, women music journalists, you are much more empathetic towards people, you know, depending on what your life or how your life has panned out. But I think sometimes when the brats come on set or, you know, people just want to outshine or feeling intimidated, it's such a personal weakness on their part that it's sometimes not even directed at you. It's actually just emanating, you know. It's like this, I definitely believe in, you know, frequencies coming from a human body, and it's sometimes so overwhelming.
Absolutely.
You know, absolutely. But I think that's incredible that you could see, you can and observe it and know exactly when to identify it, as opposed to, again, I suppose if you were young, in it for a long time, in it for the wrong reasons, you can get so affected.
Oh, I've still been affected. I mean, it was tough. I mean, the series things were tough,
especially I'm sure.
the second time it happened, because it was so, I'd never seen anything quite like it. By the time the thing with the movie happened, that was after the series. So I knew, first of all, it was a much shorter period of time, and I had a better sense of how to deal with it.
Right. You're better prepared.
Yeah.
I mean, that's terrible were, but at least you had that. So what do you do in that moment? Do you pander to it? How do you deal with that? Because obviously, you know, peers and networking and connections in Hollywood is vital for, you know, I feel like, especially with acting, one of the most challenging things for actors is that you land in a position of really always having to ask approval. You know, you have to go for castings, you're asking to be hired, you're having to prove yourself. So how do you navigate that when you are faced with people who might necessarily clash, or at least, you know, come in the way of your art?
Well, the thing that I started realizing after my first experience, and then after the second experience, I really realized is that nobody's going to help me. So you go to producers and you complain, and then it's like, we don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
Like, because this guy's higher on the pecking order than you. So it's, you know, I mean, that's not what they said, but that's essentially, do you know what I mean?
Right. It's the intentions there. Yeah.
Yeah. This is a white male lead, and he's going to do what
exactly.
He's going to do. And we're just going to try to put up with him as best we can.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm like, geez, wow, really? Okay. So when the movie thing happened, well, first of all, this person came at me so. What was interesting is that I'd worked in another film with this person, so I'd kind of, without having any direct scenes with them, so before, so I'd kind of gotten the 911 about him.
Right.
So so when they came at me and actually gave me an acting note, I just pushed back. I mean, the first thing
they gave you an acting note, and this was a fellow
actor. Yeah.
The gall. That's awful.
Yeah. And I literally said, wow, well, I disagree.
Oh, good for you.
I mean, I looked at him, and my head dropped, and I said, wow, well, I disagree, but let's try it both ways. Okay.
Well, that's pragmatic.
And the person, they got their eyes, I mean, their face, because they're like, I am so-and-so, and you're this person that I don't really know who you are. How can you be talking back to me like this? I mean, they freaked out.
And just
not
because,
freaked out, but I mean, it was like, they were like, okay.
Well, because you obviously caught them off guard. Yeah.
Yeah. Well. And then from then on, it became a war of attrition.
You started a war, Lance. How did you do that?
And I didn't think so. So there was another scene later where this person had a big monologue in a scene, and I had a moment at the end of the scene, and the thing that worked about it is that our characters hated each other, so that helped. But this person had a monologue in a scene, and I had a line, and it was a huge group scene with a lot of extras, and I had a line at the end of the scene because this person's the plot of the moment was that this person had this idea that ended up being a disaster. And because I outranked the person, I just said, you're done. You're done. So, you know, when that moment happened in rehearsal, I took a beat, a big beat, and I said, you're done. And immediately this individual starts, I don't think it should be this long pause. She just needs to move really fast. And, you know, do you agree? And then she turns to the director, do you agree? And he goes, yeah. I think so. I was like, wow. Okay. So,
and especially not having, as you mentioned, you know, having all these people around you that are particularly maybe of a different race, not from the same background. You never know the person's personal views. You never know where it's coming from. And as you said,
this thing didn't feel about race. It was just about
class. Yeah.
So,
which is upsetting because I wonder if they would have said that to somebody else, you know, and if that's how they're treating people that are
the other two people in the scene who are bigger, one person in particular who had been nominated for an Academy Award twice.
Wow.
And he and I got along great. There's no way this person would have done that to him. Yeah. No way.
Yeah. And you don't deserve that. Yeah. You definitely don't deserve that to somebody to throw you off. But I think that even just talking about it now, it's so fascinating to find out that that could have really derailed someone else. If it wasn't, you know, if they weren't you, it could have derailed
them. It would have derailed me years earlier. But here's what was interesting about what happened with that particular thing. Is that then we shoot the scene, and you know I'm in this group of other people, and just by virtue of the way they shot it, they went through the scene and they did us in the group, me and these other two actors. They did our close up first. We're actually watching the thing happen, and I'm online. Then they turned around, and then the scene went very quickly. We turned around, and when it came to this person's coverage, they slowed it way down. I was like, wow.
I want to put that in a ringtone. Wow.
Oh, yeah.
I need to bottle that up.
But the thing about it is that big moment that I have at the end of the scene, they still had to do a close-up of me for that moment. So that person slowed it way down. Then they did the moment where I'm listening, and then I have my reaction. And I swear to God, this person starts making faces and ad-libbing on my close-up.
No.
Absolutely. I'm not making this up.
But that's gaslighting. That's gaslighting. It is, in a sense, because they're doing that to... Wow. I won't ask you who this person is, but I hope... I never come across that person. That's awful.
Oh, I can't tell you because you'd know immediately. I mean, they're very famous.
Yes.
But anyway, so what was interesting was, you know, he said, great, check the gate. And this is force in my head that just kept saying, I can't let this happen. I can't let this happen. So I'm sorry. I need another one.
Good for you.
And he's like, really? That was good. I said, yes, I need another one. And it was late, and it was like 100 extras. I'm like, no, I need another one. So I said, now I know what this person's going to do. I'll just pretend they're a piece of furniture, and they can do whatever they do, and I just wait for the moment, and then I'll give it. And that last take was great.
And you're proud of that now. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And interestingly enough, the next day in the makeup trailer, my chair's right next to this person.
Oh, God.
And they say to me, Lance, you know, last night when you left, it seemed like you were, it wasn't just your character, you were really mad. And it seems like you were, you know, I just want you to know, you know, what I was doing, I was just trying to help you because I know your character's supposed to be accepted, so I was just trying to get you going. I said, I think it's just a matter of style. If you don't want me to do that, I won't do that anymore. I said, please don't do that anymore. It was very clear that the person was did that in a public forum, because if they really wanted to apologize, they'd knock on my door, come into my trailer and apologize.
Yes.
But they did it in a public forum because they were doing damage control so that, you know, they set up the conversation first So then if I went and started saying anything about how fucked up it was, then I'd look like the bad guy.
Yeah, exactly. And then if you ever had to, you know, smear their name or say something bad, they could just turn around and be like, well, I apologized. I don't know why he's being so sensitive.
I don't know what he's talking about. I think he's a great guy. I thought we got along. I don't know what's going on. Yeah, I was very clearly what that was.
And it's so fascinating because even if it isn't, as we were saying earlier, even if it, these people don't know you, that person's on set working, you're at a job. And I think that line sometimes gets crossed when you are faced with someone whose ego is completely in the forefront of their art, of their job, of their life, of everything. And I feel like that's such a harsh way to live. I feel my sympathy goes out to somebody like that, because can you imagine how many conversations that person has probably had in a makeup trailer like that? You know, I'm sure they've had a few, because I doubt that you are the only one who they've done that to, because it just doesn't sound like, it sounds like very commonplace behavior, you know, unless you just totally riled them and, oh, that's really, I'm so sorry that happened.
Oh, it was a learning experience. I mean, yeah.
What were some of the most memorable, not teachers, but peers that you worked with then? You know, you mentioned Paul Giamatti and studying with him, and you've obviously, you know, got to work with a internet and world icon, you know, like Keanu Reeves. So, and he's notorious for his nature, just to fans. I mean, I haven't really spoken to, you know.
He is a prince.
Yeah, I can
imagine. I love that man so much.
Yeah.
I mean, all the hype, he lives up to it. I mean, as a human being.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Yeah. I can imagine.
And when it comes to the work, he's all about the work. There's no bullshit. Mm. No ego. Yeah.
So in terms of then artists, like musicians that you then look to, you know, as inspiration, because how often do you then revisit that side of your life? You know, because you are a working full-time actor, so how do you visit the music side of your heart, you know, to make sure that it's still stoked and still, you know, still there somewhat?
It's, you know, it's interesting, because about 5 or 6 years ago, I started writing classical music again just to get my juices flowing, because I hadn't written a song in like over 10 years.
Wow.
And then I off and on the past few years, I've been kind of working on this piano suite. And it's just been in the back of my mind. I just feel like I need to start writing songs again. And one of the things I'm going to try to do is to start just kind of doing, because one of the things I realized, just as me as a personality, is that the life of touring that I understand is a kind of the reality of a musician's life. Oh man, I don't want to do that.
No, it's not it's only it's grueling, but it's also, in this day and age, unfortunately, it is the only source of income. So
now that the internet is destroyed,
it's awful. But there's so many, there's so much goodness about it. So, and there's so many actors as well. You know, Steve Martin's a fantastic banjo player. There's so many people. Can you imagine if you formed a super group?
Well, he's kind of, talk about a polymath, that guy.
Oh my God. I think
Steve Martin's amazing.
Unbelievable.
He's somebody I would love to work with. Yeah. I mean, I have never heard a bad word about him.
No.
And he's so talented. I mean, it's so smart. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
Could you see yourself in a comedy, a comedic role? Could you see yourself tackling that after, as you said?
I mean, obviously you haven't seen Corporate.
Well, I know you have.
Or have you?
No, I have, but I know that that's something that, again, you are often turned to for that tough guy. You know, the people know that you can play that role with your eyes closed. You're so good at it, which is probably so frustrating to people who can't do that role. but, you know, what is in the future for you in terms of the dreams that you have kind of always wanted?
My dreams have changed, partly because the reality of race and kind of the gap between what I thought was possible and what's really available has sobered me.
Mm.
Um, The Wire was the beginning of that education. When we were treated, we were literally, I mean, there was no doubt. Now, it's widely regarded as the greatest dramatic series in the history of American television. But at the time, I mean, we were on HBO at the same time as The Sopranos and Six Feet Under and Sex and the City and Entourage. And those shows were getting award nominations up the wazoo. And when it came to The Wire, it was crickets. It was like we didn't exist. And we knew how good we were. It was disgusting.
Yeah.
So, but now, it's so interesting because of all the film that I've been able to do and being able to do corporate while I'm doing Bosch, and I've been able to do so many other different kinds of roles, I'm kind of living the dream now. I mean, I did two films this year. One I played, oh my goodness, what can't I think of her name? Oh, this is terrible. I just did another film with her. She's becoming one of the biggest movie stars in the world. She was a star in the last, I can't think of her name. She was a star in the last minute black movie.
Oh,
she played the Valkyrie in the last
horror
movie.
Oh my gosh, she's fantastic. Tessa Thompson.
Tessa Thompson. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I just played her father in a wonderful period romantic romantic drama. It's a very different kind of character. After that I did an independent film
I've been talking to you for too long. That's why your brain is now like tired.
But I play this. It's a comedy. I play this pastor of this progressive church in L.A. Who's adopted this young white guy, he's well-meaning kind of ne'er-do-well. Who has this idea to do a Christian film to help save the church? It's all about kind of thematically. It's a bit of a send up of how corrupt a lot of the Christian film industry can be.
Absolutely, yeah.
And how much it's run by people who have nothing, who have no faith and have no connection to being Christians, and how bad a lot of those movies are, and how much money they can make. It's a send up of that. So I get to play kind of this corny Christian pastor.
I mean, that sounds great. And especially because, as you said, you know, it's kind of sobered you up, the thought of just knowing what is possible. And also because you already have this beloved fan base that know you and know your capabilities, I think that surprising them with, you know, different characters and different roles is so exciting. On the show, what we usually do is find out what my guest's first performance or concert was that you ever saw. I know you mentioned Sting earlier. So what was the first show you ever got to experience? Or, because you're an actor, maybe the first film you got to see?
Wow. I mean, I grew up watching so much film on television that I don't remember the first film I saw. The first two concerts I remember ever going to, one was a school outing in elementary school, and it was a symphony, but it was a daytime performance of varied pieces to give kind of kids a taste of classical music. And then the other, believe it or not, I was in elementary school, and I can't remember how old I was. I think I was eight or nine. I saw the Jackson 5.
Oh my God. Wow.
Yeah.
This
is in Baltimore.
In Baltimore.
At a place called the Civic Center. Yeah. Oh. Where I grew up. Yeah. At a place called the Civic Center, which is a huge, it's been revamped, but yeah.
Do you feel like that seeing them had some sort of effect on what you've been able to do? Do you feel like they inspired you, or at least just, you know, made you think about that world of music and performance and art?
believe it or not, I wasn't a big fan of the Jackson 5. I went because a friend of mine invited me to go with his family. And I just said, okay. I actually, believe it or not, it was the Partridge Family. I wanted to be David Cassidy. My parents got me a drum set when I was 10. Mm-hmm. And I would come home and sit for hours, and I would play Partridge Family records, and I'd play the drums and sing to these.
What is something that you wish someone might have told you about performing when you began acting? What is that one thing that you feel, you know, in a more like altruistic sense, what kind of almost advice would you have wanted to hear before you started going down this beautiful path that you've had in your professional career?
As far as acting, when I started, gosh, I don't know, because I've been so fortunate. And when I started acting professionally, I was so kind of arrogant about how good I thought I was, how talented I thought I was, that I felt like I was stumbling a lot in terms of performance. That happened later as I got bigger and bigger roles.
Right.
And I realized that my performance wasn't always consistent, especially if the writing wasn't good, if the director wasn't good. Man, that's a tough one. Because on the one hand, I'd never tell anybody to do it the way that I did it, but the way that I did it was so perfect for me.
How would you tell people to do it? Like, you know, you mentioned your daughter earlier.
I wouldn't.
you wouldn't tell anybody to do it?
Yeah, I wouldn't give it. I mean, I'm sorry, the King Lauren. I wouldn't tell anybody not to be an actor. That's not what I mean.
Yes,
but in terms of giving advice on how to, I mean, partly because it's changed, the industry's changed so much, but even back then, if there's one thing, it's more professionally than artistically. Because the artistic stuff, that was more, everything that I learned, even along the way, was stuff that I had to learn through doing.
Right.
I don't feel like there was anything anybody could tell me that was going to help.
Right.
But professionally, I think that I wish I'd understood how soon I needed to start thinking about being in charge of my career, as opposed to, something one of my first agents said to me was, do good work and let them come to you. And I wish I'd understood what a lie that was.
In what way? Just because that isn't a finite action. You can't just expect people to come to you. The comment that this
agent made to me was out of my complaint about not having more opportunities.
Right. Right.
That is true to a certain extent, but that's very much a white guy's frame of reference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I believed it was true because I believed I knew how good I was. And how good I thought I was predicated as much, if not more, on how hard I worked at the craft is how talented I thought I was. Because it wasn't that I knew I was talented. I mean, I never questioned that I was talented. But once I got to Yale, it was like everybody's talented.
Yeah.
So it's more or less an even playing field. Well, except for Paul. But it's more or less an even playing field. So the only thing that's going to give me an advantage is that I'm better at the craft.
And you're continuing to do that with every experience as well. You know, you talk about somebody like Paul. Look at his career. I just binged.
Well, he was shot out of a cannon.
I mean, that guy. I just binged Billions actually the other day because it was one of those shows. I don't know why I had a block. I just couldn't stand watching a bunch of white guys who are rich fight. And then I thought in my head, you know what? I've got to just do it. And the writing is phenomenal. And when you said earlier that it really can help an actor to have good writing and have a good director, I mean, it's mind-blowing, that show. So have you seen or spoken to him ever since your Yale class over the years?
Oh, I was just on the phone with him yesterday.
Paul
and I stay in touch. I mean, when I was in John Wick last summer, we had lunch a couple times. No, we've been friends ever since.
That's fantastic.
He and one other person, I keep in touch with one other person. They're my closest friends from drama school.
From drama school.
Oh, yeah, Paul's great.
And have you worked with him yet? Or do you feel like you...
You know, we haven't worked together. We have not worked together since school.
Wow. I feel like it's time. it's time for that to happen. You got to make.
Well,
I'm trying.
I keep trying to get them to do this.
You got to talk to your people. Got to make it happen. But that would be wonderful, especially considering it, you friends. You know, can you imagine bringing
it's
energy?
Funny.
Yeah.
It's funny. I called him up yesterday to ask him some producing advice because he's the producer of one of my favorite comedies on television now. You know, a lot of people don't know it. It's called Lodge 49.
Oh.
On AMC.
Yes. Okay. So
have you seen that show?
I haven't seen that show. I'm going to be completely honest, which is strange because I feel like I'm quite. Wow.
It's its own thing. It is completely a character-driven piece. It is brilliant. It is brilliant. It's based on one of the co-showrunners is actually the guy who created the world because it's based on his short stories.
Oh.
And I don't remember the guy's name, but he'd never written a script before. He'd only written like short stories and. I think essays and novels.
Wow.
Yeah.
I feel like that probably attributes to, like, as you said, knowing too much can sometimes, it can sometimes not help the process. So maybe because they don't, he doesn't know much about script writing, it probably helps his work. Wow.
Well, in terms of trying to, the thing that seasoned showrunners often do is try to do what they think works. As opposed to being true to the originality of the idea, because one of the things that's been another thing that's kind of been a hard wake up over the past couple of decades is how much I don't want to say ubiquitous, but how much most studio executives rely on numbers.
Of course,
and the past to make decisions about programming. That so because so they don't have to have taste, because what they're doing is going by formulas, numbers, and formulas from the past. But ironically, I mean, what becomes the breakout hits are things that are completely original that people haven't seen before. But nobody wants to take a risk on that.
Absolutely. It's again, to be honest, it's likened the same in the music industry and the same in Broadway. On Broadway, it's that they think that people want familiarity, but we actually want to be yanked out of our seats.
Yeah.
You know, we want, that's why The Good Place and I suppose talking
that's
about
what
the
a
canon.
Great show.
Oh my God. The Good Place is one of my favorite. Talking about writing. Now that is a writer's room. I wish I could be a fly in the wall. Oh my gosh. But wait, so is Lodge 49, is that a talking about titles? Because I don't know anything about it, but is that alluding to The Crying of Lot? Is that Pynchon's? Does that have anything to do with Thomas Pynchon's The Crying of Lot 49?
I wonder if that's the same.
Yeah, I'll go and look it up. Very well. Thanks for giving me a recommendation. That's all.
Oh yeah, that's a great show. That's a great show. And, I think they just finished shooting the second season. So
you asked him about production tips or producing
tips. Because that's the thing I didn't get to. You know, one of the things I realized that I really, really want to do is I want to produce great stuff, great television and film.
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, that would be phenomenal, especially because of the way that your brain works, your experience, the depth of the roles that you've, managed to do. I feel like you would be the perfect person for that. And also you have clearly what it sounds like is compassion for the actors as well, so as well as the story. So I think you'd be perfect. Oh, well, I'm excited to hear what else you start getting involved in. And I hope he gave you some good advice or at least some good tips.
He did. Yeah.
Say no more.
A lot of it was just about how hard, it really is as hard as it sounds.
Yeah. so there's no easy way in. This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kibble, and we'd like to thank Billy Yost and The Kickback for our theme song, Rube, and buy their music at thekickbackband.com, Daniel Brater and Dean Berger for the additional sound design,
and the Consequence Podcast Network, where you'll find a bunch of other amazing shows. Hey! If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts? Your comments provide valuable feedback for us and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod and generally just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again, and I miss you already.
Consequence Podcast Network.